From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a House committee held public hearings on the BP oil disaster, where BP CEO Tony Hayward underwent a grilling. For weeks, both legislators and experts on cable news have tried to put the mounting disaster in perspective by making comparisons to the size of the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989.
20 years ago, the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons in the water there. And fishermen say
to put that in perspective for you, the Exxon Valdez spill dumped 11 million gallons of oil.
It was a tremendous destructive catastrophe for Alaska, and it was only 11 million gallons of oil.
But where did that figure, 11 million gallons, come from? Many people, including Ricky Ott, a marine toxicologist, author, and former commercial fisher, argues that 11 million was Exxon's very early estimate and not the actual amount. Ott, who was in Alaska during the Exxon Valdez spill, says it was a dubious figure from the start.
Right off the bat, day one, when I was in Cordova flying over to Valdez, we heard that there was a low-end estimate of 10.4 million gallons and a high-end estimate of 38 million gallons. And the next day, it was nudged up to 10.8 million gallons. And the media just captured that number. Already, 10.8 million gallons was horrific. It was the biggest oil spill in our nation's history. It was big enough for the media.
Are you saying that the media simply ignored the high-end estimate, or Exxon stopped repeating it?
Exxon never said it in a press conference. Just when the media started to ask questions, where did that 10.8 million gallons come from? Has it been independently verified? Frank Iarossi, the owner of Exxon Shipping, at a press conference said, alcohol may be involved. And I kid you not, I witnessed the entire international media just switched tracks, and that was how we got 10.8 million gallons, rounded up to 11. A couple years later, when I saw the movie Wag the Dog, I saw that scene where the president was just about to get nailed, and a plant in the audience says, well, what about the bombs in Albania? And the whole media switched to bombs in Albania. And I rose up out of my seat and I said, that is how we got 11 million gallons. And my two friends each grabbed a wrist and pulled me back down into my chair. And I just swore that I would never forget 38 million gallons.
So you're essentially saying that the media have the attention span of a puppy. In other words, they ask a question and then the Exxon Valdez managers go, look, a squirrel. And then they're off and running and they forgot what they asked.
That's pretty much exactly what happened.
Did we ever find out how big the spill really was? There was one person who said, all you have to do is measure what's left in the Valdez, and then you can figure out how much spilled. And the Valdez was supposed to hold something like 53 million gallons, right?
The state of Alaska went and hired independent surveyors because they were preparing for a lawsuit. This was a secret investigation. The code word for it was ACE. Each of the two independent surveyors tracked the amount of water that offloaded from Exxon Valdez, which amounted to around 19 million gallons. We have to remember that 8 of 11 cargo holds were ripped wide open. There was a 21-foot tide going in and out twice a day, and it just acted like a washing machine. So if you add 19 million gallons of water in with the 11 million gallons of oil that we know spilled, you actually end up with closer to 30 million gallons. And that's what the two surveyors estimated spilled, between 30 to 35 million gallons.
So why is the 11 million number still quoted everywhere? Why isn't it now regarded as disputed?
When the data popped out, the secret investigation popped out in public, 4 years later, it was no longer news. And it's extremely unfortunate because we did write legislation at the federal level and at the state of Alaska to protect us from an Exxon Valdez-sized oil spill, which means that we are underprotected by three times.
Do you think the media have been smarter when it comes to the Gulf oil leak? Have we seen some progress then?
No, I'm sorry to say, because all the numbers are repeated that are given by BP. There's no demand by the media to say, where's the independent monitoring? Our government didn't even ask for it. What I thought was hilarious was when BP actually started claiming that it was recovering oil, and suddenly the recovery numbers were greater than the spill numbers. So the next thing you know, the spill numbers had to jump up. But the media still is not asking BP the question, how much of what you're recovering is water?
So what is the lesson here for reporters?
The minute we have an oil spill, assume that it's going to be underreported on the how much spilled and overreported on how much was recovered. And the reporter should be framing questions for the American public. Why are we taking the spiller's information without questioning it at all? Why isn't the federal government out there? Why aren't the universities out there? We know how to get accurate information. We should be monitoring everything the spiller does.
Are you sure that that information is accessible? Can the government and academia and the experts that you refer to really go down there and get the information that is available to the oil companies?
It's not a matter of going down there. BP released to the public that underwater flow that we keep seeing, that video. That was not high definition. That was very low quality. And it turns out BP all along had a high definition video camera down there. They just didn't release it to the public.
And if experts had been able to see the real flow in detail, they would have been able to estimate.
Yes, because that's what they're doing now.
Ricky, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Ricky Ott is the author of Not One Drop, Promises, Betrayal, and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill.
Good evening. As we speak, our nation faces a multitude of challenges.
Thus, on Tuesday evening, commenced Barack Obama's first address to the American public from the sober, hallowed, quintessentially presidential confines of the Oval Office. Presidents usually choose other settings as thematic backdrops, notably George W. Bush declaring victory in Iraq aboard an aircraft carrier.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But when the issues are grave enough, the commander-in-chief speaks to us from the center of his command.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
Enter the Gulf oil spill. Obama recognized a historic opportunity akin to the banking crisis when Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel sagely observed, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. So, with the dual goals of demonstrating that he was on the case and selling his energy policy built around capping carbon consumption, Obama sat at his massive desk and, in a mere 18 minutes, covered the spill, the administration's response, the environmental implications, BP's liability, and the notion of Deepwater Horizon as a historical turning point, an offshore Pearl Harbor, arousing a complacent society once and for all to free itself of carbon dependency. Yes, we can, the president said, because we have history on our side. We have American pluck and ingenuity on our side. And on top of that, God will hold our hand.
The blessing is that he is with us always, a blessing that's granted even in the midst of the storm.
The notices were not very good. John King of CNN suggested it was too political. Roger Simon on Politico.com said it was insufficiently detailed. John Dickerson in Slate said it was insufficiently confrontational. And RedState.com, pulling out the long knives, compared it to Jimmy Carter's so-called malaise speech. Youch. But while pundits across the board agreed the speech was a dud, it seemed they couldn't quite put their fingers on the problem.
I thought it was a great speech if you've been on another planet for the last 57 days, but what was needed tonight?
I didn't feel any energy in the first two-thirds of the speech in which he talked about cleanup. He's not a cleanup guy. He's a guy who dreams and who changes the country.
Executive command. And I thought that was the purpose of the speech tonight.
What if the dissatisfaction had less to do with the text than the subtext, or more accurately, the subconscious? Having used his Politics Daily column to predict the substance of the speech, pretty much point by point, Tuesday night, Walter Shapiro noticed something disconcerting about the look of the thing.
I think that there is a reason why, in selling his health care program, for example, he didn't use the Oval Office address. In talking about his Afghan policy, he didn't use the Oval Office address. I really think they realized that this is not a setting that shows him off to best advantage. Somehow, he looks small.
Yeah, behind that massive piece of furniture, this vital, dynamic, telegenic president indeed appeared slight, gangly, almost adolescent. Was that the President of the United States trying to reassure and persuade us, or the Secretary General of the Model UN?
Here we have the worst environmental eco-catastrophe facing America, and we are talking about how a man looks sitting behind a desk. I hate to lower it to that level, but we all know, for better for worse, such atmospherics tend to be important in forming political perceptions.
But of course these things matter. In his campaign, Obama had tried once in a TV commercial to approximate White House trappings, but quickly abandoned the technique. There, too, he had looked diminished, sapped of the power, the electricity, and the almost spiritual command he brings to a podium. In his Politico column, Roger Simon wrote, quote, "Maybe using the Oval Office upped the ante too much. Maybe we expected too much." Right, and maybe we were disappointed, even though we weren't quite sure which expectations hadn't been fulfilled.
Coming up, Apple wants to keep its products clean. No breasts, no penises, and no dirty words like sperm.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This month, an independent daily newspaper called Newsday was launched in Zimbabwe. That country has lacked an independent daily since 2003, when President Robert Mugabe shut the last one down. For the past 7 years, the only daily newspaper has been the state-run Herald, which, unsurprisingly, has been a propaganda tool for Mugabe and his party. But after a disputed election in 2008, Mugabe entered a power-sharing agreement with opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, and one consequence was that licenses would now be granted to new and independent papers. A few licenses were granted at the end of May, and within days, Trevor Nube, who already publishes two independent weekly papers in Zimbabwe, had Newsday up and running. He says the public's reaction to Newsday has been pretty positive, but there have been a few logistical problems, among them the price.
The paper is being sold at 50 U.S. cents. In Zimbabwe, we don't have coin for change. So people have $1 notes and they need to get 50 cents change. So we've devised a system by introducing coupons or tokens, which are plastic round tokens, which we give to people as change. And initially when we started, we didn't have enough of those. So that has tended to depress the sales. And the other thing is that the 50 cents is not attractive to our vendors who get a cut from selling the newspapers. They get 10% of the cover price. We are the cheapest newspaper at the moment, and we did that deliberately. And the vendors would rather sell a newspaper that's $1 or above.
Weren't you too clever by half? Had you charged $1 for the paper, you would have had easier distribution and you wouldn't have had to come up with this token scheme.
You got a point, but our competition is a government newspaper that's been around for 110 years. So we needed to come up with a strategy that would make this our newspaper stand out. And we thought this was a very clever idea.
Can you give me an example of some of the stories that you have run in the last week or so, or maybe one story that exemplifies exactly the kind of journalism that hasn't been done over the last 7 years?
There is, as I'm talking to you now, a campaign of intimidation that is taking place in Bulawayo, which is Zimbabwe's second largest city. The government has said that foreign-owned companies that don't have local shareholders will be forced to take on local shareholders. And there's been a campaign in Bulawayo over the past week of people driving in to these companies to say, we now own these companies, we want you to get out of the country. So it's that kind of stories that require a bit of digging, require a bit of courage that the Newsday is going to be dealing with.
The last independent daily in Zimbabwe, the Daily News, was shut down by Mugabe's government in 2003. That office was firebombed. Tell me, over the last 7 years, what it's been like for journalism in that country.
We've had our journalists abducted, tortured, some of them just being caused to disappear for weeks on end. I myself have had my citizenship taken away. As I'm talking to you now, the editor of Newsday has a case that is before the courts where if he's found guilty, he could spend 20 years in prison. So that's the kind of environment. And as a result, most journalists in Zimbabwe left over the past 10 years, which poses a challenge for us trying to start a newspaper in a country where most of the skills have left.
I must say, when I learned about your new enterprise, I was shocked that this regime was giving out publishing licenses to any independent entity. Was it merely the power-sharing arrangement with Shangarai that made this whole enterprise possible?
To a large extent, it is. Currently, there are targeted sanctions against the government of President Robert Mugabe. And the government of President Robert Mugabe has been calling on the international community to lift the sanctions. The Zimbabwean government needs to show commitment to democratic reform. And one of the key issues towards democratic reform is a free press. And that is contained in the global political agreement between the government of Robert Mugabe and Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. So the issuing of these licenses is in part an attempt by the government of Robert Mugabe to show the international community that they are committed to make some form of reform.
Are you not concerned that Mugabe will wake up tomorrow morning and decide that he wants the whole lot of you in jail?
Yes, you might wake up one day and find that things have been changed. But I think the changes that have been set in motion would make it rather difficult for a reversal to take place. And if indeed it does happen, it's not something that would stop me from doing what I'm doing. I'll be proud of what we've been able to achieve, giving Zimbabweans an opportunity to read an independent daily newspaper.
Trevor, I wish you all the best of luck, and thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Trevor Nobe is publisher of Zimbabwe's new independent paper, Newsday. In the early days of the internet, digital pioneers made bold predictions about our future interconnected world. The future was synonymous with free. Indeed, the idea that information wants to be free, says Michael Hirschhorn in the current issue of Atlantic, has been the most powerful meme of the past 25 years. But that meme, he argues, is now moderating. Hirschhorn's essay, Closing the Digital Frontier, is in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Before we go anywhere else, I want to ask you about the notion that, quote, information wants to be free.
Stuart Brand, who was a fairly significant and hugely influential pioneer in the digital world, was at a hacker conference in 1984 and said information wants to be free, but he also said that information wants to be expensive because it's so valuable. And so there's a tension between freedom and cost. What's interesting is that the phrase just kind of turned into information wants to be free. And then there was a kind of second level of confusion between the use of the word free as in freedom of expression, which is something we can all get behind, and free as in lack of cost, which is something that I think is a lot more controversial.
Yeah. However, I guess if you followed the path of mass media of the ensuing 20 years, you could just forget that he was talking about a paradox and just glom onto the first part of his statement and say, well, I guess he was a visionary because traditional media started giving away their content for free online. What is happening to reverse the thinking about the free online universe?
Apple, as always, was very prescient, really making the case through their app-centric iPhones and iPads that that's a better place for people who create intellectual property to put their content. Advertisers are happier on there. It's harder to steal content. As a result, content and media companies are going to be removing their best and most timely content from the internet, from the browser system, and the browser system is going to suffer as a result.
I got to tell you, this sounds still a little bit squishy to me, so let's get down to a concrete example. So let's talk about the Times. There is the Times Online and its monetization problems, and then there is the New York Times app coming to the iPad. Tell me the difference.
I think that the Times will be able to offer what is more a reading than a browsing experience through their apps. It'll be a more organic multimedia experience. It's something that feels like you should pay for it. And they will stop putting that content on the web. They haven't said that yet, but it's pretty inevitable because otherwise, what's the point? And when that material starts being taken off the web, because why would they start an app business if they are giving away the same information through other sources? The thing that's interesting to me is where that leaves the rest of this internet culture. That internet culture, I think, will increasingly be something we look back on in a nostalgic fashion, because as pieces of premium content increasingly get walled off, the internet might start feeling a little bit like a kind of red light district where you go to get illegal content and have illicit interactions, because the official internet—
Potterville.
Exactly. The official internet is being spruced up and turned into a mall. There was a remarkable exchange between a writer from the Gizmodo blog and Steve Jobs where they started emailing, and Steve Jobs referred to wanting to give the world a gift of quote-unquote freedom from porn, which has a kind of hilarious Orwellian ring to it. And, you know, I obviously think Steve Jobs is a genius and a god living among us, but he has a very specific vision of the world, and that is a clean, ordered experience in which technology is used as a facilitator for commerce.
But there's still two warring ideologies, right? There's the free ideology, and then there's the likes of Steve Jobs, who believes in commerce.
Very broadly and a bit reductively, there is going to be a kind of battle royale between Apple and Google, and it's going to be thrilling to watch because Google is built on free. Google is built on search. The app is threatening search. Google is relying on an almost infinitude of free-form travel through cyberspace that it can harness to sell contextual advertising. If we're casting about for metaphors, it's going to be the digital version of the Cold War.
Yeah, but, you know, the graphics will be better. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Michael Hirschhorn is a contributing editor for Atlantic Magazine. His piece, Closing the Digital Frontier, appears in the July-August issue.
In the early 1920s, the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice declared the James Joyce novel Ulysses obscene, and the book was banned. 90 years later, Apple did the same. This month, the App Store rejected a graphic novel adaptation of Ulysses called Ulysses Scene because several panels contained images with really vague nudity. It took the U.S. courts about 12 years to reverse its ban last century, and it took Apple, well, about a week or so. But the case underscores the growing frustration many feel over Apple's seemingly mercurial censorship decisions. Chad Abumrad is the host of NPR's Radiolab, a fascinating show about all things science. It has a very popular podcast. Chad, can you tell me how not too long ago Apple took a little bite out of Radiolab?
Well, I actually only discovered this a couple days ago. Someone ran into my office and told me, do you know that they're censoring your sperm show? We did a show on sperm, which was very, I wouldn't call it PG, but it was a very tame version that looked at all kinds of interesting things relating to sperm. And so I went on to the iTunes description, and it was, in fact, censored. Although, would you call this censored, Brooke? It said SP...
Asterisk
M. And I had thought, actually, that we had done that. I remember when we were making the sperm show, I would do that in my emails. Because the spam filter that mediates our email communications, if it sees the word sperm, it would put it in the junk mail. And so I thought we had done it. I didn't even realize Apple had done it.
Sperm is a dirty word?
Sperm apparently is a dirty word.
Wow. Thanks, Jad.
Sure.
Jad Abumrad, host of NPR's Radiolab. So do we want Steve Jobs to act as a de facto V-chip for users of Apple products? Adult users of Apple products? Daily Finance media columnist Jeff Berkovici has followed some of the more prominent cases. Jeff, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier, I made a reference to how James Joyce's Ulysses, at least in graphic novel form, fared on Apple. Now let's talk about another one. This one was a graphic adaptation of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, and it was also briefly banned by Apple. How come?
The reason it was banned was there were some panels that had drawings of gay men kissing. I think they were actually imaginary. They were in sort of thought bubbles, but there were pictures of gay men kissing and in various sexual positions. And Steve Jobs, or whoever is in charge of this, anticipated that it might be offensive to some of their users.
The graphic novel Importance of Being Earnest, like the James Joyce Ulysses, was briefly censored and then uncensored. What happened?
What happened was the creators objected. They wanted to know why their app had been censored. And then when some human being actually went and looked at it again, they determined that, in fact, it had artistic merit. It wasn't pornography.
Don't human beings look at it in all these cases? I could see having certain key words getting automatically expurgated, but don't humans have to look at pictures?
They do, but there are tens of thousands of apps submitted that they have to consider, and it seems like they are giving only the most sort of cursory consideration to what's coming in, and then only really looking at it once somebody raises a flag. It seems like the default here is to flag something if anybody might object to it, rather than to wait until somebody actually does object to it.
Let's talk about topless women. Obviously, much of what Apple has censored involves not just illustrated nudity, drawn nudity, like in graphic novels, but actual nudity. A couple of big German publications have felt Apple's censorship knife in the past year.
Yes, Bild and Stern, two pretty prominent German publications. Both of them had their apps blocked for a while because of this. Stern had sort of an erotic photo gallery, whereas with Bild, they had an app where you could shake the phone and a woman's clothing would fall off, and Apple didn't like that.
Now, we should say that despite what you've just described, Bild and Stern are both major publications. These aren't marginal girly mags.
Oh, they're huge. And this is something that, you know, Americans who aren't terribly familiar with European publications might be a little surprised by, but nudity there is fairly mainstream compared to how it would be. I mean, you would never open USA Today and see a topless girl, but you can open The Sun in England and they have the page 3 girl who is, you know, always topless.
So how did the German magazines respond?
They both pretty much knuckled under. I believe that Stern hasn't run that kind of content since then. Bild pushed back a little bit, but they too were willing to accommodate Apple because in the end, you sort of have to work with Apple. Right now, it's illegal to jailbreak your iPhone to alter the programming so that it can run apps that aren't approved by Apple. The Electronic Frontier Foundation wants to grant an exemption to that law to make it legal. Their argument basically is that by only allowing the iPhone to run approved apps, they're stifling competition throughout the market for app development because their control is so great.
So explain to me why Apple is so fastidious in keeping material that might offend somebody off its site. It strikes me that if you're creating an environment that's safe for a 9-year-old, then it means you're creating an environment that lacks all risk, all excitement, all challenge for an adult.
All James Joyce, all Oscar Wilde. Yes, Apple is a company that is one man's vision and one man's whims. And Steve Jobs, at some point in his life, got it into his head that people What they want from Apple is to be shielded from what's unpleasant, whether it's unpleasantly bad design, he's done a wonderful job of shielding us from that, or whether it's the unpleasantness of internet porn that you accidentally stumble onto. His impulse has always sort of run counter to the chaotic, democratic nature of the internet. He wants to give you an environment that's very controlled and curated, and in general, people have responded to that well. So I think that's why in a lot of these cases, he's sort of erring on the side of when in doubt, throw it out.
Both the iPhone and the iPad come with browsers. You can go to any website, pornographic or otherwise, using Safari.
I'm on a pornographic website right now.
Are we just getting the choice of two internets, the clean, well-lighted space of the Apple app world versus the potentially seedy, if more exciting, browser system?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who think that all of this talk about how apps are going to be the dominant mode of consumption on tablets and on smartphones are kidding themselves. All the things that make apps so hugely attractive to media companies, the idea that they can really control the environment, that they can, you know, serve you this sort of richer advertising that's harder to opt out of, all of those things are exactly the things that make it less attractive to a lot of media consumers.
Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeff Berkovici is the media columnist for Daily Finance.
Coming up, how Brazilian soccer fans played a joke on Twitter and all of us, and the long road to the truth about Bloody Sunday.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Carlos Eduardo dos Santos Cavalo Bueno is a play-by-play announcer who calls the World Cup matches on Brazil's largest TV network, Rede Globo. Last weekend, someone in Brazil offered a blunt critique of Galval's broadcasting style with a three-word tweet in Portuguese. Cala boca Galval, or in English, shut up Galval. The phrase quickly became one of the top worldwide trending topics in the Twitter sphere. And what happened next, says Ethan Zuckerman of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, was the result of a wired world eavesdropping uncomprehendingly on one another's conversations.
For the last 3 or 4 days, Cala Boca Galvao has been absolutely at the top of the topic list. And so what happened was a lot of non-Portuguese speakers saw this phrase, didn't know what it meant, and started tweeting, what does Cala Boca Galvao mean? If there's a new topic trending on Twitter, there's probably a significant chance that it has something to do with Lady Gaga. So some of the Brazilians grabbed that idea and started telling the non-Portuguese speakers that Cala Boca Galvao is the new Lady Gaga single. You know, the problem with this is that eventually you have to come up with a single for people to listen to. People start searching for it and they figure it out very quickly.
Because just to clarify, there is no single by Lady Gaga called Cala Boca Galvao. They just made it up.
To the best of our knowledge, Lady Gaga has never consciously recorded a single called Cala Boca Galvao. But this is, of course, the wonder of the internet, is that if you now go onto YouTube, you will find half a dozen purported Lady Gaga Cala Boca Galvao. The real tour de force in all of this was someone realizing that you can't go wrong on Twitter coming up with a worthy, well-meaning cause for people to get behind. And so you started to have some very clever Brazilians saying that Cala Boca Galvao is an international campaign to save the rare endangered Galvao bird. And that if you were to join in and tweet Cala Boca Galvao, 10 cents would be donated to the Save the Galvao Foundation. And quite rapidly, Brazilians started to come up with some wonderful supporting materials for this. So you can find a poster that declares, help us save Galvao birds, 1 second to tweet, 1 second to save a life. And perhaps most wonderfully, you can find this minute-long public service announcement,
which focuses on spreading the word about Galvan,
a very rare kind of bird native to Brazil. Every year, more than 300,000 Galvan birds are killed during carnival parades. Their colorful feathers are sold on black markets. And if this slaughter doesn't stop, they will become extinct much sooner than you can imagine.
A campaign to raise money to create hermetically sealed birdhouses to allow the birds to survive.
So this is a hoax built upon a hoax stemming from an insult at this stage.
Look, in seriousness, what's so amazing about a space like Twitter is that one click away are all of these conversations that you don't know anything about.
It's the Twitter version of the media echo chamber, right, where you're exposed only to ideas of people you have self-selected. But with the trending topics, we can really get an instant look at kind of the zeitgeist.
And what trending topics does, by giving you a small slice of zeitgeist, it lets you see at least what some of the other big conversations out there. In cases like Calabouco Galvão, where you get led in the wrong direction, I think those are probably the rare cases.
So this episode is actually significant for being the exception that proves the rule.
One of the great functions of sport is that it gives you common ground where you can talk to people from countries all over the world. The World Cup becomes this sort of wonderful excuse for conversation across national lines, sometimes even across language lines. And a lot of that conversation has to do with taunting one another. So I view this as a very well-constructed taunt.
Okay, Ethan. As always, many thanks.
As always, great to be with you. Thanks, Bob.
Ethan Zuckerman is senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Igor Ribeiro is executive editor of Imprensa, a magazine about media and communication in Brazil. We asked him if he thought that Calabouco Galvão was a typically Brazilian stunt.
Yeah, kind of. The translation of it is simply Shut Up Galvão, a sports announcer from one of the most powerful TV broadcasts in Brazil. And everybody, if they make a little research on the internet, on Google, they will find out that there is no such a thing as a Galvão bird or a movement to save it. I think it's something that became bigger than the people who started ever thought of.
Okay, I got to ask you one thing.
Uh-huh.
Galvão, has he had anything to say about this episode?
Yeah, he said that he doesn't care. And even some comedians who work in the same broadcasting TV where he works made a kind of opposite joke. They posted in their blog movement called Fala Galvão, means Speak Galvão.
All right. Well, Igor, good luck saving the mythical bird and good luck in the cup.
Thank you a lot. Good luck for U.S. team, too.
Thanks. Igor Ribeiro is executive editor of the Brazilian media and communications magazine, Imprensa.
This week in Britain, the publication of the Savile Report, passing what presumably is the final judgment on what led to British soldiers killing 13 people and fatally wounding another during a civil rights march in the Northern Ireland city of Londonderry on January 30, 1972. I say final judgment because an official investigation launched soon after Bloody Sunday laid the blame on the marchers. The Savile Report reached the opposite conclusion. It found that the soldiers' attack was entirely unprovoked and that some civilians were shot even as they crawled away. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron on Tuesday.
I never want to believe anything bad about our country. I never want to call into question the behaviour of our soldiers and our army, who I believe to be the finest in the world. Yeah. But the conclusions of this report are absolutely clear. What happened on Bloody Sunday was both unjustified and unjustifiable. It was wrong.
Former Prime Minister Tony Blair ordered the Savile investigation in 1998. 12 years later, it has finally set the record straight. In a story we did in 2002, we noted that among the thousands of people to give evidence to the Savile investigators were several reporters who were on the ground in Londonderry in 1972.
there I was sitting in my Manhattan apartment 27 years later, and the phone goes, and it's the Savile Inquiry in London announcing to me that they have five of my notebooks, which I had used during the time that I was in Derry in 1972. And I have to say I was shocked.
Peter Pringle was an investigative reporter with the Sunday Times in London when he was sent in by his editor, Harold Evans, to try and determine what happened in Derry that Sunday. All was confusion and contradiction in Derry. A civil rights march was underway, but no organized violence was planned by the Catholic side. The IRA had even declared it was taking the day off. Police and British regulars were tactically deployed, armed, as always, with purple dye-firing water cannons and rubber bullets, all except the paratroopers, straight from service in Cyprus. They had their standard self-loading rifles.
Tell me what happened when the paratroopers came in, Father.
They came in and they just came in firing. The people, there was no provocation whatsoever.
Firing what, rubber bullets?
No, it was lead bullets they fired.
A short while ago, we filmed you leading the way with a white handkerchief.
Yes.
For a party who were carrying a boy who was dead or dying. Now, how was he shot?
That little boy was shot when he was running away.
I don't believe they were shot in the back running away. A lot of us, in fact, do think that some of the people were shot by their own indiscriminate firing.
General Robert Ford, commander of the land forces in Ireland, said they intended only to separate the stone-throwing hooligans from hundreds of peaceful marchers and arrest them. And he denied the evidence that lay in the streets of Derry. The editor of the Sunday Times was Harold Evans, a journalist with an investigative bent, frequently brought before the bar for various violations of Britain's Official Secrets Act and privacy and libel laws.
The government announced that it was setting up an inquiry by Lord Widgery, and a notice came to all the editors that we should await Widgery's report to see what actually happened. After talking to him, we decided what we should do was mount a parallel inquiry by sending our very best people over to Northern Ireland so that when Widgery came out, we would be able to say an excellent report, or, as in fact we did say, Widgery is a whitewash.
Our idea was that we would get at the truth, and we would probably get closer to the truth than the Widgery inquiry. You know, they didn't have the access that we did.
Peter Pringle.
It was a curious thing to be a reporter in Northern Ireland because you could, in the morning, go to the normal press briefing of the British troops. And in the afternoon, you could cross the line, if you like, and go and talk to the IRA leaders.
But the most telling bit of evidence collected by Pringle and his reporting partner, Philip Jacobson, were the audio tapes, complete with time codes of the Army's radio communications, taped surreptitiously by a local shop owner.
Every afternoon, when the aggro started and the young Derry hooligans, as the Army caught them, started throwing stones, Mr. Porter of the Porter's television would go up into his upstairs room and record the army messages. And he made a full recording on this day.
Zero, this is 7-6. Two high velocity shots heard in the area of the Rossville flat. People are lying on the ground now.
It was a stunning piece of evidence, which the British government inquiry under Lord Widgery rejected. Why did they reject it? They rejected it because they said it had been made in sort of clandestinely and was against the Official Secrets Act and couldn't be used in evidence. Well, of course, if you don't use the tape, then you can't reconstruct the day.
Soon after the Widgery inquiry was released, exonerating the British Army of any wrongdoing, Pringle and Jacobson published their 12,000-word account of Bloody Sunday in the Sunday Times. Conservative members of Parliament accused Harold Evans of betraying his country, but otherwise, the story barely made a ripple, and it sank, under the weight of Widgery and a largely unsympathetic public, into a sea of subsequent events.
It was so fast-moving that nobody had time to stop and examine the difference between the government's report and our report, but it had no shelf life beyond about a week. After Bloody Sunday, there was Bloody Friday, there was Bloody Wednesday, there was Bloody Thursday, and more people died in a single event in those bombings and shootings than they did at Bloody Sunday.
How did they get into this mess?
Harold Evans.
There were so many theories being bandied around that had no basis in fact. So-and-so is saying it's all the fault of Lloyd George, or so-and-so is all the fault of the IRA, or it's all the fault of De Valera or Michael Collins. But what are the facts? And so once you resolve to get into the facts of the situation, you have a tremendous momentum to continue until you've nailed as far as you can that shadowy, elusive thing called truth.
The frustration of investigative work is that you may see it and feel it and even write it, but you only have one chance to get out the word, unless by some miracle it comes around again, which brings us back to Pringle and his moldering notebooks, which had languished for 27 years in the archives of the Sunday Times until the Saville inquiry demanded the Times hand them over, and the paper, under the aegis of managing editor Richard Casebee and owner Rupert Murdoch, complied.
I wondered immediately what my notebooks looked like. I wondered immediately what on earth they might contain that I didn't want anybody else to know. I wondered whether they would want me to translate them from my very shaky shorthand, and why I would do that, and whether I should do that.
Pringle finally determined that he should, though he won't divulge his sources, as Lord Saville demands. He doesn't actually believe that Lord Saville will arrive at the truth. Too many people are dead, or they can no longer remember, or they remain silent still. But he does hope for a proper reckoning for the people of Derry.
Think of this. 13 people died on Bloody Sunday. The compensation that was worked out 2 years after the event for the four teenagers who died was £250 per dead body given to the relatives. When I first heard this, I thought to myself, I would love to end this book with an interview with the civil servant who signed the cheque to give £250 to the mother of a teenager who was shot in the back.
As it turned out, Pringle was overly pessimistic. As victims and their families gathered at the Guildhall in Derry on Tuesday, they saw the truth emerge after all. It took approximately 2,500 witnesses, 160 volumes of evidence, and nearly 200 million British pounds. Peter Pringle, when did you start to believe it would work?
Well, only on the day of publication, which was on June the 15th, basically. Everybody who went into the Derry Guildhall, the lawyers for the dead and wounded, the relatives for the dead and wounded, simply didn't know what Saville was going to say. They opened the boxes and they were given 2 hours to read it before Cameron's speech. And the relatives of the dead and wounded gave the thumbs up sign, and the whole crowd outside just erupted in clapping and cheering and clenched fists into the air. So it was right up to the last minute that nobody was really certain about it.
You wrote recently in The Guardian that the Saville Commission seemed to subscribe to a Rankean view of history. Can you summarize that?
Well, basically what 19th century German historian Leopold von Ranke said, if you're reconstructing history, dip your bucket as close to the source as possible. Or, if you like to put it another way, a witness's second thoughts about what happened are probably unhelpful. You know, he's had second thoughts about it, it's been tainted in some way.
In other words, your unassuming little notebooks were where the bucket was closest to the original event.
Yes. What do we say? Journalism is the first cut of history? We probably took the first statements of the witnesses. Then they made their own statements to the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. Then some of them made statements to that first inquiry. And then they finally made another statement to the Saville inquiry. So when they actually got into the witness box in front of the Saville inquiry, they had three or four versions of what they believed at the time and then could remember 30, 40 years later. But it was quite extraordinary to see Saville take our original notes and then from there build this case. And curiously enough, Saville was not a criminal lawyer. He's a contract lawyer. And so everybody thought when he was appointed that it's a long way from the courts of contract law to dead bodies in the bogside. That's what his colleagues said behind his back. And so they thought he would be completely swamped and wouldn't ever get anywhere near what he did get. And that's why others, including myself, were skeptical.
Peter, thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Peter Pringle is co-author with Philip Jacobson of Those Are Real Bullets and Bloody Sunday, January 30th, 1972, and most recently of The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Alex Goldman, Brett Jaspers, and Michael Chaplin, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson, and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.